Welcome to the Lobot Lounge, the gathering place for the gentlemen nerds. The gentlemen nerds are three entertainment aficionados who know each other through various media endeavors, getting together to talk about all things nerdy, mostly in the vein of film, television, toys, and popular culture. Many topics are discussed, so please be warned, there are the potential for many spoilers. If you like what you hear, you can listen to past shows on iTunes or on our website, thegentlemannerds.com. And now, enjoy the show. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Lobot Lounge. Today, the gentlemen nerds turn their attention to the topic of copyright. You know, the rights to intellectual properties, established brands, protected likenesses, images, stories, and themes. Please note, the Gentleman Nerds is copyright Cloak and Dagger production. Gathered here in the Lobot Lounge, as always, is Mark Finn.
Hello, everybody.
Who appears to with us courtesy Ape Man Inc. And Aaron D'Arrive.
I am not Mickey Mouse.
Copyright Hawkman Dives, LLC. And I'm Joseph Fotinos, your host and emotional touchstone, and I'm sponsored by Dolly Madison, maker of all kinds of neat-to-eat treats. Welcome to the Lobot Lounge, folks.
Hi, everybody, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Yeah. So the topic of copyright, that's a sticky one, folks. And for those of you out there that know us individually or as a group, you know we cover all kinds of topics on this show. This was brought up by our dear friend Mark. And we thought, what a brilliant idea, because really, in the wake of Disney's corporate conglomerate takeover of the universe, this deserves to be addressed. And I think we all have had our own personal encounters with the issues of copyright, and I know, you know, each one of us have a great story or two to tell, but I want to talk about this personally and in a broader sense, what it means to have this protections and how it can either prevent or assist in creative endeavors.
Oh yeah, and real quick, I want to just go further down the credit hole. The topic was suggested to me by my good friend James.
Oh, okay, thanks, James.
So James, thanks for the topic. Everybody, I'm really looking forward to this discussion because we've all got different angles that we're going to come at this from. So hopefully, you guys will enjoy it as well.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah. Thank you, James.
Yeah. So, let's go ahead and just talk about some of the basics of copyright. Just if somebody said copyright, what's that? And of course, it's, you know, protections to properties and themes and stories and characters that are, you know, protected for monetary purposes. Really, it's all about money, right?
Yeah. It always comes down to money, and there's three terms that are kind of used interchangeably if you don't know what they mean. Mm-hmm. So essentially, copyright, which is literally the right to copy, in this case, publish, existing works of art, whether it's a TV show or a book or a play. These are all protected by copyrights. And so originally, the idea for copyrights, Ben Franklin thought, should be the life, after he dies, he thought that 20 years, two decades, was more than enough time for his offspring, who did not write any of the things that he wrote, to make money off of his creations. He thought 20 years was acceptable. After 20 years, anybody could publish Poor Richard's Almanac. Yeah. If you were so inclined. And so copyright basically covers just that. The other thing that unfortunately gets kind of tied up in this is trademarks. Mm. And trademarks are a different thing entirely. It's actually a kind of legal status. Mm-hmm. So a trademark is something that's associated with an LLC or a corporation or a partnership or something like that, and it usually involves likenesses. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there is a more protected class of this called the registered trademark. Right. And so these three things do very different things, but they go hand in hand, as we will get into within the course of the program. So so we'll be using these terms, but and we're going to try to use them legally accurately. But if we don't, we would really appreciate it if you would get on to Facebook afterwards and tell us how wrong we really are.
Yeah, in fact,
actually are very. I was going to say we're actually very lucky to have a line right now to our secret attorney who dwells in a cave, Dr. Gonzo, and he's with us here, and will be chiming in from time to time to correct us if we go a south or askew on some of our legal terms. Dr. Gonzo, are you there?
I'm here. I'm going to point out that none of this is legal advice, and if you get your legal advice from podcasts, you've made mistakes in life that you need to consult a lawyer about.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Gonzo.
That is true. And by the way, so for our listeners, allow me quickly just to introduce, many of you might know him as the composer of the music that is used for the Gentleman Nerds podcast, but this is the lovely and talented Ben Gibbs, who is our new producer, editor, sound recorder, mixer. He is in fact a lawyer. In fact, recently just passed his bar. And so, yeah, so he is Dr. Gonzo Esquire.
Yes.
For those of you that that are interested. But we are very, very lucky to have him and very happy to have him join the Gentleman Nerds here in the Lobot Lounge. And so, yeah, you'll probably be hearing from Ben in the future. He'll be joining us on certain podcasts that have an interest for him. And actually, he probably should be chiming in on the one on copyright and trademark since he's the lawyer. Nothing that we say here on this podcast should be taken as legal advice. Not a single word. So
not even life advice. Don't listen to us.
That's right.
But
we're useless.
Gentlemen, glasses up. Welcome, Ben.
Yes, Wesley. Yes, huzzah.
So I want to bring up another issue about that Mark, in your opening there was very well put, but there is something that I was notably absent that you did not mention, and I want to bring it up because I like it when it crops up from time to time, and that is likeness. Yes. Likeness is something that is protected as well, and I will point to one of my one of my favorite characters in all of cinema history is Bela Lugosi as Count Dracula from Universal's 1931 Dracula. Bela Lugosi Jr. is an attorney, and he lives in Los Angeles, and he is extremely, extremely protective of his father's likeness and the use of his likeness on things like toys and t-shirts, model kits. I mean, everything has to go through the Bela Lugosi estate through his son, the attorney, to get licensed. Now, you're going, well, okay, sure, why not? How hard can that be? Well, it's a little harder than you think, especially when Lugosi Jr. has a stranglehold on his father's likeness as Dracula specifically, but other things too. Everything that's produced that wants to have Lugosi's likeness has to go through him, and he has vetoed so many things, which is why Universal, in their wisdom, has decided to do a generic-looking vampire guy whenever they do Dracula. You'll see it on a lot of their promotional artwork. You know, you go, oh, that's obviously Karloff's monster. Oh, look, that certainly looks like Lon Chaney's Wolfman. Who the heck is that? That's not Lugosi, because they can't use Lugosi's face. There's pros and cons to this. We as fans and collectors, we suffer because we get generic-looking vampire guy. But back in the 60s and 70s, which is why I love that era of collecting, a lot of the Dracula stuff came out looking exactly like Lugosi, and nobody could do anything about it, you know? So, but now, I mean, and Karloff, too. Sarah Karloff owns her father's likeness and protects it, but she's a little bit more lenient with the uses of her father's likeness. And the same thing with Ron Chaney. Ron Chaney, the great-grandson of Lon Chaney Sr., owns both their likenesses and can authorize
now,
their uses.
Now, okay, so that leads to another interesting question. So likeness, got it. You know, we protect the way Bela Lugosi looks. What about voice likeness? Because, you know, I think of the monster serials where one of them clearly is trying to sound like Bela Lugosi, blah, blah, kill Dracula.
That's regional dialect. Lugosi grew up in literally in the shadow of the Carpathian Mountains.
I know, but I mean,
so that's what he sounds like.
Is that also protected? Because
I think that you can get away with by going, hey, he's talking like a Hungarian. Peter Lorre was Hungarian.
Karloff, Karloff has a very, Frankenberry. It's like, that kind of sounds like Karloff, or Peter Lorre, friend. Yeah. But I guess that's not, Dr. Gonzo, would that be protected? Could that be protected?
That is a really complicated question.
Okay, too complicated for this podcast.
Because you're talking about inflection and a lisp, a genetic disorder, or my accent. Is it the actual voice? No, but it's something very similar to the actual voice. It's like when you do a parody song, you're not doing the song. You're doing the song, but it's a parody song, so it's kind of like the song, but not really the song.
Gotcha. I was just thinking of Bobby Boris Pickett and the Crypt Kickers.
Okay. That's right.
Okay. That's interesting.
In fact, that was done as a joke. Boris Pickett and Leonard Capizzi were in the studio doing some songs, and Bobby just happened to do a really good Boris Karloff, and he did a song as Karloff, and it was hilarious. The studio was rolling, and they went, "You really should do something about that." So he and Leonard Capizzi went home, and they wrote the Monster Mash.
Wow, nice.
Yeah, it was just a joke, but it was like, hey, that sounds really kind of cool.
Ben, you were going to say something. What were you going to say, Ben?
So that's probably going to be a trademark question, and the standard for trademark is okay. The super simplified version of the standard for trademark is a question of brand confusion, and so if you're going to cause brand confusion, then that's when you get into the sort of that's when you start to infringe, and
that's right. Anything that could be construed as deleterious to the existing brand could be contested. Yes.
Now, and that's a nice segue to this story. Florence Stoker, the widow of Bram Stoker, since we're talking about Dracula, was protective of the rights to the story of Dracula, the book that was written by her husband, Abraham Stoker. Friedrich Murnau, filmmaker, decided to do an unauthorized version of that story and called it Nosferatu. He was very careful in trying to hide some of the elements. He changed all the character names, Count Orlok instead of Dracula, the Baltic states instead of Transylvania. He did his best to kind of hide it. He didn't do that good a job because it's very Dracula. I mean, you watch the movie, you're like, oh, this is Dracula. Yeah, of course it is. It's just a different name for the vampire and a different look. I mean, Nosferatu stands on its own for a number of reasons, but it is incredibly Dracula. It's an unauthorized telling of Dracula. There's no doubt about it. Well, Florence took this to court, said, no. That's my property. My husband's dead. I own it now. No, you cannot use it. So she and the judge found in her favor, and they had ordered all prints of Nosferatu, A Symphony of Terror, to be destroyed. And they were, to a certain point. Thankfully, we know that wasn't fully carried out, which is why we enjoy this film today. But Florence Cranky Stoker had to be consulted on a number of Dracula issues in the 20s. In fact, they used Bela Lugosi himself, Universal Studios used Bela Lugosi himself, the original Bela Lugosi, as an emissary to Florence Cranky Stoker to get the rights for Universal to do the film. Because Lugosi had success on Broadway, which Florence approved, but then, and really liked Lugosi's performance, so they said, well, he's our guy. Lugosi, can you please talk to Florence and make sure we can do this movie? This is even before he was promised that he could be in the role of Dracula on film.
Oh, wow.
He was still doing it on Broadway. And Lugosi was vying for this role hardcore. He took, literally no money for this role, by the way, because he wanted it so bad. But he was a huge hit on Broadway, and Universal still didn't necessarily want him to be Dracula. They were looking at Conrad Veidt. They were looking at Lon Chaney Sr., who died, unfortunately, before the film was done, and eventually said, okay, we'll use the Lugosi guy from Broadway. I mean, literally, that was kind of their mindset. But they used the hell out of Bela. They were like, hey, can you do this for us? And Bela, of course, was like, absolutely, because he's thinking, oh, yeah, I'm going to get to play the role, Yeah, they negotiated the hell out of Florence to get those rights, and it's thanks to Lugosi himself who managed to pull that through.
Nice.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. Now Universal's likenesses are pretty easy to understand. When you're dealing with estates, as you mentioned, sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad. Right now, the likenesses and the registered trademarks of several public domain characters are in the hands of either estates or trusts or corporations. This includes Tarzan, Sherlock Holmes, Conan,
Dracula, Frankenstein,
and so forth. And so while the works themselves may be in the public domain, the first eight Tarzans and the first six John Carters, for example, are in the public domain, meaning anybody who has access to the text as it was originally published can publish that originally published text. And there's a lot of pulp stories that fall in this realm as well. Even though you can publish it, if you want to utilize Tarzan to publish your Tarzan book, you have to go to the estate to do it.
How does something fall into the public domain, either Dr. Gonzo or Mark?
Dr. Gonzo will correct me if I'm wrong. The Senate has basically set a limit on when something becomes public domain. Right now, it is for works published after 1960 something.
78.
Oh, excuse me, 1978. It is the life of the author plus 70 years.
Yep.
And for works prior to 78,
it's very complicated.
There's a series of baffles that fall one by one as things fall into public domain and fall out of public domain. And it used to not be such a lengthy process. It used to be anything I write is protected for 70 years afterwards, after my death, which is just, it seems like a long time. Here's why this is being done. Walt Disney has lawyers and they have people that are the lobbyists in Washington whose sole job, and they spend a lot of money on it, is to get them to keep moving the goalposts on when things fall into the public domain, because they never want Mickey Mouse to fall into the public domain. Even though Mickey Mouse is a registered trademark of Walt Disney Inc., they are weirdly terrified of anybody else being able to do anything with Mickey Mouse. And here's why I think that's bad. Two reasons. One, there is no possible way for the public to separate Mickey Mouse from Walt Disney. They have expertly and efficiently, through decades of brand management and indoctrination, linked Mickey Mouse to Walt Disney and Disneyland and all that. The ears are ubiquitous. I mean, we know what they are. You just need the silhouette and you know who he is. He's that famous. And so it would be very unlikely that anybody could do something to do their own Mickey Mouse movie or whatever that would hurt Disney. Right. Now, that said, that would be protected under trademark, registered trademark.
Yeah.
The problem with what they're doing with this copyright extension is that in their desire to protect their intellectual property, they are screwing everybody else process.
Now, what do you mean by that? How do you mean this?
There are a number of works where that are technically orphaned, or if not orphaned, are uncontested.
Yeah.
And this applies to songs as well.
You know what?
Material that should be in the public domain. And isn't.
But hold on. It really depends also on how litigious the trust or LLC or corporation that holds the particular copyright or trademark is. In many cases, they are more than willing to work with creators and give very reasonable fees or whatever, the licensing fee or whatever you have to do. In order to use the property. Let me briefly launch into, I have a very, very personal story about copyright and trademark and all that. My writing partner and I wrote a script called Deepest Darkest. Now, Deepest Darkest is something I thought up years ago. It's essentially taking the story of Tarzan of the Apes, the original Tarzan of the Apes, and telling it as a horror story. From the perspective of a jungle crew who's lost in the jungle, and at the very beginning of the script, they one of the hunters purposely kills this big, mysterious, weird-looking ape, and it's Kala, Tarzan's mother. And so he cuts off her hands, and they go off on their way, and then later on they hear this horrific scream, and Tarzan has found his mother. And Tarzan then proceeds over the next 95 pages to hunt them down and brutally murder them. Great story, I think. Great take on Tarzan. No one's ever done that take on Tarzan, because this is not the perfectly manscaped, shaven, me Tarzan, you Jane Tarzan. No, this is a feral, monstrous creature raised by apes, fights like an ape, thinks like an ape, but has the cunning of a man. So we thought this was a great idea, and we thought, yep, let's do it. This would be a great freaking horror movie. But then, of course, the whole thing came up, but it's Tarzan. Well, here's the trick, and here's what we did. It is Tarzan if you call him Tarzan. Right. If you use the names that are used in, and by the way, this is one of the, this unfortunately falls into that, what Ben has said is very complicated. Tarzan was published in 1912. Mm-hmm. So when it is now clearly 1912, it is clearly in the public domain. And you can go on the Kindle on app and on Amazon, and you'll find all kinds of people offering copies of Tarzan of the Apes. They just, they reprint it. They go, here it is. We're selling it 99 cents or whatever it is, and you can buy it. And that's what the copyright in that case means. When the copyright expires, you can take that original story and you can publish it yourself in an electronic format or whatever you want to do. And again, Ben, correct me if I ever say anything that's incorrect. And you should be okay. What the Burroughs estate does, I think quite wisely, is they use the trademark. Back to what Mark was saying about trademark. Because that can go on forever and ever and ever and ever, as long as you keep defending it and as long as you keep, re-upping it. Trademark is what they use to protect the image of Tarzan. So So they'll say, no, you cannot do a Tarzan, whatever, comic or book or novel or a TV show or whatever, because it's going to harm our property. It's going to harm our IP, which is Tarzan of the Apes.
Right. There's a certain set of physical characteristics that Tarzan displays, right, and a certain way that he's depicted.
That said, those set of characteristics are very loosely defined, because if you notice, there are at least half a dozen Tarzan clones of various different names, such and such, the Jungle Boy and Kazar and all these other kind of characters that are essentially Tarzan.
Yeah.
But they're not named Tarzan. So that's how we got around, although if it's life of the author plus 70 years in 2020, there'll be no, that will be up. There will be no question about whether Tarzan is in the public domain or not, or at least the works of Tarzan.
Right.
But the trademark remains. But we got away with it by nobody in the book ever says Tarzan. Nobody says Greystoke. Nobody says Jane Porter. None of the things that are used in the story recognizably, except that it's a story that takes place in Africa. That's pretty much it. Does our script have in common with Tarzan? So we're pretty sure that if someone did Deepest Darkest, there would be no problems. If there were, because again, it depends on how litigious people are.
Right.
Well, if the Burroughs estate wanted to say, hey, then whoever's making the movie throws them a little bit of money, and it's all good.
Now, what about Disney? And we brought them up before because we talked about litigious groups and how litigious they are. There's a lovely saying in Hollywood that inside that white fluffy glove, there's an iron fist.
Yes.
Disney is very, very protective. And I've got one other besides Tarzan, because Disney did Tarzan. They did a Tarzan story. But they did it
in conjunction with the Burroughs estate.
That's right. So, and I'm going to back up just a little bit because the other film that they did, which I can speak to with some authority, is The Hunchback of Notre Dame. They did a Hunchback of Notre Dame. Beautiful film, by the way. Love the Disney version. Very nicely done. Hits all the right points. But in that era, in that time that Hunchback was being promoted and was out there, and they had toys and they had all this stuff, you couldn't use The Hunchback of Notre Dame. And to this point, Polar Lights re-released the Aurora Monster model of the Hunchback of Notre Dame, but they weren't allowed to call him the Hunchback of Notre Dame because Disney had a stranglehold on the title, the film title, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, for a time. Now, Dr. Gonzo can chime in here, but I think that a public domain film, especially if something that Disney comes and does it, they'll take that title and they'll go, nah, you can't, because you'll confuse people. They'll think, is this the model kit from this cartoon that's out there? No, it's not. So they had to change the name to The Bell Ringer of Notre Dame for the model release.
Yeah.
And that's all because of Disney. Now, for Tarzan, enough time has passed. Maybe they don't have the stranglehold on any of that idea before, but it's enough different. They don't call it the name. So I think the title is, if it's recognizable, if somebody looks at a catalog and says, oh, there's a model kit of The Hunchback of Notre Dame. I remember that cartoon. That was cute. I'm going to get that. And then you get this in the mail, and they're like, oh, shit, what's this?
Right.
It looks like Anthony Quinn on the cover with an afro. That's terrible. I don't want this.
But you're right. I guess it does depends on how litigious, because I don't see anybody. I mean, maybe only Disney can get away with that, because if you came out with something and called it Dracula, if you came out with something and, anything that is done way back then, they could not take you to court. Right. They could. But I don't think they would win if they took you to court and say, no, you can't call this Dracula. You're like, what do you mean I can't call this? Of course I can call this Dracula.
Right.
I don't know. But Ben, can someone defend a title of a work that is out of copyright?
There are definitely ways that can be done. Yeah.
Okay.
I do want to follow up on one point about Tarzan.
Okay.
So it's about half of the Tarzans, not quite, are in the public domain.
Okay.
I think. Like, don't quote me on that, but yeah, a lot of the Tarzan are, not all of them are, and. So, because of the way that the 1909 Copyright Act is put together, it doesn't care about life of the author. So there are quite a few of those that, even though it'll be 70 years since Burroughs died, they will not enter the public domain until later, because they would still be protected for, it's actually date of publication plus 90 years.
There it is, date of publication plus 90.
Oh, okay. But those are works prior to 78?
Those are works prior to 1978. It's not that simple, but basically. So what that means is that in 1997, there were a bunch of works that entered the public domain because of the end of they had a 75-year copyright extension.
Right.
And then in 98, they added 20 years to that. So nothing entered the public domain under that law until the end of this year. So at the end of 2018, we will get some works that were first published officially in 1923 entering the public domain.
I see. Well, then Tarzan should be definitely in the public domain. If it's publication plus 90, that's 2002.
Yeah.
Right. Well, Tarzan of the Apes, yes.
Yes.
But the last Tarzan story was published in like 1938-ish, 36.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So, they're protected longer.
Right.
Speaking of public domain and things that kind of fall out of, what we consider to be copyright, one of the most famous public domain films out there is the 1968 George Romero classic Night of the Living Dead. This unfortunate event happened because Romero and John Russo and Russell Striner all lobbied, you know, seven of their friends to toss in money, including Carl Hardman, who played Harry Cooper, into this production company that they called Image 10, because there were 10 people who donated money to make Night of the Living Dead. And they made Night of the Living Dead, and they got it distributed through the Walter Reed Organization. And, of course, it became the Night of the Living Dead. Great. Lovely. However, because Walter Reed Organization neglected to place a copyright indication on the prints, it fell into public domain. Because in 1968, United States copyright law required a proper notice for a work to maintain a copyright. Yes. And Walter Reed did not do this. So anytime you're in a movie, folks, and you're watching a movie and the character in a movie is watching something on TV and it's a horror film, 9 out of 10 times it's going to be Night of the Living Dead because it's public domain. They could put it on the TV in the background. They could do that. And of course, Romero and Russell Striner and John Russo were like, well, hell, you know, win some, lose some, right, folks? And they went on to do other things and carry on their careers. But the thing that started their career, ironically, the start of the flesh-eating zombie film as we know it is in the public domain.
I have it is fascinating, and it's especially all of this is prescient because of the recent acquisition of Fox by Disney. And you know, what we're talking about is, you know, something is in the public is protected for 70 years after the death of the author, or, you know, life of the author plus 95 or from date of publication plus X, Y, or Z. And this is something that, actually runs a chill down my spine. I may be the only one of you that finds this terrifying, but currently the courts have defined corporations as people. And corporations can exist far in excess of the lifespan of a person.
Well,
so you have material that's in the hands of a corporation, which can technically not ever die as long as there's a board of directors and other certain requirements are maintained. Owning material that could conceivably never fall into the public domain. And there's a reason why you want things to fall into the public domain. It is because certain books, certain characters become a part of our experience. They become a part of our zeitgeist, if you will. It's important. You know, the reason why Moby Dick is called the great American novel is because it's been taught, it's been discussed, it's been taken apart and sifted. It's been shown unequivocally to be a novel of the American experience. And I think about what would happen if Melville's estate had been in the hands of a poopy pants.
Florence Cranky Stoker?
Yeah. Yeah.
Cranky Stoker. You know, the funny thing is, again, another similar situation that I have had personal experience with, Peter Pan. Let me briefly talk about Peter Pan. I actually like the conditions of using the Peter Pan IP that the estate, the Barry estate, which they gave that to a hospital, a children's hospital.
Right.
And their terms are very, very pretty straightforward and actually very generous. They will allow pretty much anybody to do Peter Pan as the stage play is written by Barry for, I believe it's a donation to the children's hospital, which is very cool. But it only covers the actual play written by Barry. It does not cover derivative works. If you do a derivative work, of which we did, again, like we love to do, a horror retelling of the Peter Pan story called Never Never, if it is different from what Barry wrote, then nothing. They require nothing. They don't come after you. They don't try to sue you. They don't do any of that kind of stuff. But it has to clearly not be Peter Pan. You know, it can have some of the characters have similar names, have similar situations, that kind of stuff. But and so I like that kind of deal where they're actually protecting the original work. And in a very generous way, of course you can do Peter Pan. We want to do Peter Pan for a Christmas play, says, you know, small town USA school. Mm-hmm. And they go, great, yeah, no problem. Make this small donation to the Children's Hospital and do it, you know. I like those kinds of situations. It is, as Mark pointed out, it's the hungry, scary corporate monster that I worry about, that they get this stuff under their roof, and then you know, now it's the cartoon, you know, the cartoon oil baron guy with the stretching suit and the big cigar going, you know, all right, you know, big piles of money behind him.
Well, let me tell you, it's not just the corporations. Back 1,000 years ago, I was the creative director for the Violet Crown Radio Players. And I was looking into the possibility of, in this case, re-recording a very famous radio show that was a very influential radio show called I Love a Mystery. You may have heard of this. You probably haven't, and I'm willing to bet most of our listeners haven't heard of I Love a Mystery by Carlton Morse, and here's why. When this thing came out, it was huge. I Love a Mystery was a serialized radio show that ran in 15-minute increments for decades. It was popular to a fault. All the stories were well written. They made several movies using the I Love a Mystery format. And what it was essentially a small group of talented individuals who found themselves investigating mysteries. Yeah. And I know that that sounds very broad, but it was actually the basis for just about everything that Hanna-Barbera did. Johnny Quest was an attempt at doing a version of I Love a Mystery. Scooby-Doo was a version of I Love a Mystery. Because the supernatural thing would always end up being not that, right? It was always a logical explanation. Yeah. Alfred Hitchcock and the Three Investigators was a version of I Love a Mystery. Yeah. This was the first pop culture formula of iteration of this type of story.
Yeah.
And when Carlton Morse renewed all the scripts, every single script for every one of his I Love a Mystery episodes, he did so in the 1960s. They all have the 1960s thing on them now. Copyright 1960, whatever it is. I think it's 1967. But this includes the episodes that old-time radio collectors don't have, episodes that have been lost because they weren't recorded. There are entire shows of I Love a Mystery that no one's heard since they aired. And so I actually tracked down the lawyer that is in charge of Morse's estate. Okay, Morse is dead. This is in the hands of a lawyer. And I told him who I was and what I wanted to do. What I thought would be great is if we take a classic I Love a Mystery story, we record it our way with the live sound effects and all that, and then we literally release it as a weekly thing on our website. And his response was, yeah, here's the deal. I actually let them do one of the episodes. I guess it was probably 15 years ago at a radio convention, and it didn't turn out very well. So, you know, unless you've got like a bigger, you know, angle that you're wanting to play on this, I'm not sure. And I said, listen, why don't you just listen to what we do? Because what we do is very authentic, you know. We actually pitch our voices up higher. I mean, we really make this sound like like the original stuff. I don't know. I think $1,500 would be like where I want to start. And of course we had 78 cents at the time. I'll send you a stick of gum, you know, with instructions on how to chew it. That's what I can offer.
Yeah.
But then I sent him a demo. And said, don't listen to the quality of the demo. Listen to the quality of our voices. And tried to call him a couple of times and never heard back from him because he deemed that we weren't big enough. So in his mind, you know, this is a very valuable property. It's so valuable, in fact, that I'm not going to let you do anything with it unless you pay me a lot of money. Yep. Well, no one is going to pay you a lot of money because nobody knows what you have because you haven't released it to anybody in decades. And, you know, and the thing is he can work with any troupe. Any old-time radio troupe that knows anything about anything would go, you mean we get to do the vampire storyline? All of them, even the missing episodes that no one's heard? And we're going to pay you a percentage of what we make rather than you charging us exorbitant amounts of money up front so that you get a little bit of money and some exposure for your brand? Wow, that's really cool. You know, there's a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it. Yeah. And there's a lot of stuff that's blocked unintentionally or sometimes even intentionally by people who are waiting for that giant payday that's never going to come. Because as of right now, when I said I love a mystery and none of you guys went, oh, I love a mystery, that should be telling right there because you guys are smart and know this stuff. Yeah. And our audience is smart and well educated. And if they didn't go, oh, I love a mystery, yeah, it's because no one's heard of it in so long because this guy's got a stranglehold.
So
that's where the problem is. That's why things need to fall into the public domain.
Well, you know what? That's a good segue to Edison's Frankenstein, Edison's Frankenstein. Which for many, many years was considered a lost film. Well, somebody came out of the woodwork and said, oh, I got a copy of it, and released snippets, just snippets, and teasingly was like, yep, I got it. I own it. It's mine. I got the only print. And he's holding on to it, just like you're saying. You know, and anything, he's very protective of it. Anytime someone does anything with Edison's 1910 Frankenstein, this very early Thomas Edison Frankenstein film, whenever you see a clip of it on some kind of a documentary show, it's because this guy got some money for it because he owns the only print. Rumors fly that there is a print of the long-lost London After Midnight, Lon Chaney's vampire story he did with Todd Browning. And this is through MG. But nobody knows where any prints are. The last known print was destroyed in a fire in the 70s in a big vault. And so the rumor is that somebody out there has a print of this and they're just waiting. Waiting until the right time when it can be truly theirs, when it falls out of complete, when it goes into public domain completely, and they can come out and say, oh, look at me, I got a print, ha ha ha, pay me money if you want to put this up, you know? I do want to share my own personal experience with copyright and intellectual property. This is tricky, folks, because this is something that you can't necessarily go, yeah, I did that first. I did. No, really, I did. There are ways to do it. In the mid to late 90s, I was a part of an improvisational sketch comedy troupe here in Austin, Texas, and we had some good success. We did some HBO workspaces in Montreal Just for Laughs Comedy Festival and Aspen, HBO Aspen Comedy Festival. So we had some good times. As part of that experience, we all wrote sketches, we all did characters, we all, you know, did that kind of thing. A couple of quick stories. We hosted a convention, a festival here in Austin, the Big Stinkin' International Sketch Comedy Festival. We called it BS. It was the BS Festival. So the Big Stinkin' Festival ran for about 3 years, and we brought in people from all over the country to our little town. And a lot of cherry pickers, people looking for talent, going to see the different shows, watching people on stage. In fact, that is how Alex Borstein was discovered. It was at our festival. The Mad TV folks were there auditioning, and guess what? She auditioned because she was with the Acme Comedy Troupe, and she got picked, and that's how Alex Borstein is now Alex Borstein. You're welcome, Alex. So one of the other things that we, our troupe, Monk's Night Out, did, we did a couple of showcase shows. And on the stage, we had a sketch. It was called Cherchez la Femme. And Cherchez la Femme had used the song, Cherchez la Femme, the famous disco song. And the sketch was basically two people at a disco, two guys at a disco trying to pick up girls, not speaking a word, but just dancing the whole time, moving and dancing the whole time, trying to pick up girls. In the audience of that show was David Koechner and Adam McKay, who at that time head writers of SNL. Then next season, the Roxbury guys premiered. And we went, interesting. Very, very similar to what we were doing at Cherchez la Femme. Could we prove it? Yeah, well, whatever. Good luck with that. One of my biggest disappointments, and the one that hit me the hardest, folks, and hand to God, this is a true story. In 1999, before the new Phantom Menace was about to be released, I wrote a musical sketch parody that we performed on the stage. It was a musical parody of Star Wars, a summary of the Star Wars saga to the tune of American Pie. And I kid you not, we did this on the stage several times. People loved it. It was very cleverly written. I wrote the damn thing to the tune of Don McLean's American Pie. And then one day, a friend of mine walked in and went, Joseph? Yeah, we can't do that anymore. What do you mean? People like it. Yeah, listen to this. And there, lo and behold, was Weird Al Yankovic's The Saga Begins to the tune of Don McLean's American Pie. Now, what are the chances of that? Now, I'm not saying that somehow that was connected. It was just one of those ethereal, out-of-the-blue things that, oh, really? I mean, how coincidental is that? Although I
There is a term for that. And by the way, you would be surprised how common that is. It's called parallel development.
Isn't that great?
And Hollywood talks about it all the time. Now, I'm just going to say very quickly, then you can get back. If all cases of parallel development just coincidence, no. There absolutely is cases of people stealing ideas. But just to let you know, this happens in Hollywood all the time.
Intellectual copyright. In fact, comedians, stand-up comedians, will record their shows. Will put a camera in the back of the little dingy rat hole theater they're performing in, and record their sets just in case their jokes show up someplace else. They can go, look, this date, the recording, I did this first. Right. That's a way to protect intellectual property. Going back to the Weird Al story, here's my theory, and I like it because it's funny. I have an image of us performing our little Star Wars parody on the stage in this small little Velveeta Room stage of Austin, Texas. And in the back of the theater, there's this guy watching, and he picks up his phone and he dials, and he puts his phone up and he says, "Hey, Al, it's me, Bill. Your cousin, slightly unusual Bill. Well, you know that new Star Wars parody you're looking for? Well, listen to this. And he holds it up.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Because of that joke, we now owe Robert Zemeckis $5.
No, we had – okay, again, just – I'm going to throw my own parallel development story because I love telling this story. We another writing partner and I had crafted an idea for a movie. We did an outline of actually very, very detailed treatment. It was like 30-some pages that we wanted to do about basically a movie about a young Leonardo da Vinci who went around and using his, you know, early scientific methods and inventions and science to combat forces that were more supernatural oriented. You know, the church was involved and there was dark magic and all that kind of stuff. And so we wrote a very detailed treatment for this, and it was called Da Vinci's Demons. Had in the treatment the outline for everything that would happen in the movie. We were thinking of doing it as a movie, of course, and send it out there. And our reps were like, "Oh, this is great! You know, let's send this out and see what the reaction is." And you know, they sent it out and like, you know, some people liked it, and blah blah blah. But you know, ultimately, nothing came of it. Lo and behold, 2 years later, somebody says, "Hey, have you seen that new show coming out on Stars?" I'm like, "No. What is it?" Well, it's called Da Vinci's Demons. And it's about a young Leonardo da Vinci using his inventions and such to combat, you know, supernatural menaces. And I was like, "You're kidding me." And they're like, no, check it out. And so I watched the first episode. And by God, if beat by beat, ours started with him testing his flying machine just outside the walls of the city and it going to disastrously, and then several beats in the action after that. Wow, I it's like a checklist. Yep, started that way. Yep, they did that. Up, oh, that's when he meets his friend. Yep, that's when he meets the girl. And again, I'm not saying it was stolen, but the talk about parallel development. I mean, the title was the same, the concept was the same, the beats in the story were the same.
Yeah, yeah. And so it was like somebody reached their hand in your head and pulled things out of your head. Because I mean, American Pie. What are the damn chances? I'm just saying. There's a lot of songs out there.
It happens. It happens a lot. And it even could have been, you know, to give the benefit of the doubt to anybody who might have come across our treatment, read it, gone, that's pretty clever. Thought about it, threw it in the back of their mind because they're bombarded by a dozen ideas a day. Yeah. And then a year or so later or whatever, like, you know, I think, you know what would be fun? A movie about a young Leonardo da Vinci without even either remembering that he read or she read the treatment and those care. I mean, it's just one of those things. And by the way, and Ben can back this up, the other issue with that is ideas are not copyrightable.
Correct.
Cannot copyright. If I describe to you what I've just done with Da Vinci's Demons, you could turn around and you can write a script exactly using the elements I have described, and there's nothing that I could do about it.
Right. No, that's correct.
Because you cannot copyright an idea.
Yeah.
You can do a script. If we had written a script and we had copyrighted that, and then somebody had actually used the script,
right?
But nope. In the treatment form, it really is more of an idea, of a concept with basic set pieces kind of put in place.
Sure. It happens
all the time. It happens all the time.
Well, our parody was to the tune of American Pie, but it was kind of hinged on the whole idea that, you know, because American Pie is about the Richie Valens, Buddy Holly, Big Bopper going down in the plane, and that kind of that segue into the world that we live in now. The one that I wrote was about Max Rebo and the Max Rebo Band blowing up on Tatooine, and it was, you know, bye bye Mr. Elephant Guy, you played keyboards for Max Rebo, then you got Blind Sky High, that kind of thing. So, but that was the kickoff to an overview of the Star Wars universe. But it was always going back to Max Rebo and the band. So I get it. I mean, it's easily done. Yeah.
But that's why they tell you. And again, that's actually bad advice to say, well, never talk about your idea. You know, if you're trying to get into Hollywood, never talk about your ideas. Well, bullshit. That won't work. If you never talk about your ideas, then nobody will hire you.
How do you pitch that though, Aaron? You've been in there and you pitched, and you sit there and you pitch your story, and you're pitching. You're talking about it, right? And maybe there's nothing written down, but would you wouldn't share anything just coming out of your head, would you?
Yeah, I mean, yes, you go into a room and you basically say, what do you have in mind? What are you working on now? That kind of thing. And you
talk about,
I've got this concept for a film or this concept for a TV show you talk about it. You just talk about it. If they're really, really interested and they think that you can pull off whatever it is that you were pitching to them, then they get involved and they become interested and they talk to you and they, you know, that can progress. But more often than not, they're like, okay, great. Thanks for coming in. And then that's it. You never hear from them again.
Until you see your idea on TV. And then,
until you turn into stars and see different demons. Yeah. Right. You know, it just that is the risk you take. Mm-hmm. It just goes with the territory. You want people to listen to your ideas and be excited by them and potentially buy them or hire you. You have to pitch them ideas, knowing that one of your or more of your ideas may eventually end up on TV or in a movie. And you go, oh, wow, gosh, I remember pitching that guy, you know, the concept for whatever. It wasn't there like there was a Toy Story thing like that where somebody was saying, oh, yeah, we pitched Toy Story. Or they even had a Toy Story, a short film or something like that then they claim Pixar took and developed into Toy Story. Now, is there a possibility that Pixar may have gone, you know, it'd be cool if toys, you know, could interact and talk to each other, but you know, when the humans come in, they don't. They're just sitting there. You know, that is not a unique idea that only one person will ever have.
Yeah, it's universal.
Yeah, exactly.
One of my favorite Gahan Wilson cartoons is a drawing of. Toys that have been clearly boxed and they're in an attic, and there's like a rocking horse and there's like a cowboy hat and a teddy bear and there's a few other things and they're all on these shelves and you can see the attic steps in the background, and the caption below says one day he'll come up here and remember all of the good times that he had and what it feels like to be young again. And then we'll get him.
Nice.
Yeah. I wasn't Gahan Wilson. It was Charles Adams.
There you go. That's nice.
So I this becomes also an issue for distributors, or sorry, exhibitors who want to play certain movies. In some cases, you've got film companies that own a film that was made 75 years ago. Nobody who made that movie is alive today. It's a property that essentially the company inherited. And you still have to pay them to show that movie because of just the simple virtue of the fact that it was part of the deal. When we bought this studio, this is what we got. And so I don't know if anybody's going to challenge Disney yet. It may start. I don't know. It's good, but if they do challenge Disney on accusing Disney of having a monopoly, it's going to be very interesting because there will not be an antitrust case or a case of monopoly ever to have developed like this before. In the past, you had a monopoly if you bought all of the tangible assets, you know, like if you bought all the steel companies, or if you bought all the railroads, or if you bought Baltic Avenue and Atlantic Avenue, you know, or whatever, you know, that was the whole point. When it's intellectual property,
right?
That's much more ethereal and not as well understood in a general court. There are people who are experts in this field, but it's a dynamic field, and right. it's because it's constantly being challenged and updated and modified. And so, I don't know what the end result is. I do know that Disney has gone from being an 800-pound gorilla to a 2,000-pound gorilla, and if they if they keep Fox as a subsidiary, the way that Columbia has been absorbed by Sony, for example, then that may be a way for them to avoid this kind of legal conversation at the Supreme Court level. But the short-term effect of it is that there are now, you know, every Marvel movie that comes out is under the Disney shield. Every Pixar movie that comes out is under the Disney shield. Of course, the Disney stuff with the princesses and the animated things and the live action versions of their animated things is of course theirs. And now Fox and all of these properties that go with the Fox brand will be, you know, under the Disney shield. And so there's a point at which you go, and of course Star Wars. How much can we buy? How much can they own? What's left? Is there going to be an upper limit?
Here's the good news. Okay, there is some good news from this, but it's a double-edged sword. So the bad news, of course, is exactly what you just described, Mark. You know, they swallow up all these really popular IPs, and they are fiercely protective of them, and they're incredibly litigious, as we know. So, you know, it's basically one big company calling the shots. The good news is, since they can't, no other studio or creative organization, entertainment organization can do any Marvel characters, well, then there's room for the invention of new characters, all right? That is the one thing that Pixar showed us. We weren't getting a great Fantastic Four movie. Nobody was giving us a good Fantastic Four movie. So Pixar said, fine, we'll give you a Fantastic Four movie. And it was a great Fantastic Four movie.
Right.
And now, and again, that's also Disney, I understand, but now there's a whole new franchise for brand new characters that I love. Incredibles is one of my favorite superhero movies. Mm-hmm. But it takes that kind of company backing it. It needs that money. Without that kind of budget, your superhero movie is not going to look as good as the last three Marvel movies, and then everyone's going to go, It wasn't that good. Now, it can shine in other ways. I mean, obviously, writing is important, very important, characters and you know, that kind of stuff. A lot of that sometimes gets lost in the spectacle.
Yeah.
But it does encourage creators.
Or just ignore it altogether.
Exactly. But I was heartened by the really good reviews that the Punisher Netflix show got, which clearly wasn't like a huge budget show, but man, it was a fantastic character study, and it was really well done and well paced and well acted and gripping and you know all that kind of stuff that I thought their more flashy show, Defenders was not. It was, in my opinion, the Defenders was a bomb. They did a great job. So that's the good news, right? So these other companies that are not currently being swallowed up by Disney are going to be looking for their DC universe, their Marvel universe, their famous monsters, their whatever it is. I mean, their Universal monsters. They're going to want to tell these stories. And if people come up, you know, creators, young filmmakers, writers, et cetera, come up and say, hey, how about this? Why don't we tell this story? Why don't we try this superhero? And by the way, that also then means there's more room for what a lot of people have been asking for diversity. Now you can get not just the one Black Panther movie, yay, one black superhero among the myriad of superheroes that Marvel has. Right. You can get a bunch of them. You can get a superhero who is of Asian descent starring in a movie. You can get a superhero who is of Arabic descent starring in a movie, of Latino descent. I mean, you know, it's like diversity opens up, again, with great stories. You have to start with that core of a fantastic script with great characters. Without that, it doesn't happen. And you can't just do it by saying, hey, I'll do Superman, but I'll call him Macho Man. That won't work. You can't just regurgitate what they've already done. You have to show them something new. I find that the encouraging part. And again, with more streaming services opening up, Amazon doing its own movies, Netflix doing its own movies, HBO doing its own stuff, Apple TV now wanting to do its own stuff, they're going to need material. They're going to need material that they want to own. They don't want to have to be paying all these fees to Disney in order to show their movies. They want their own stuff.
Yeah.
So it does. It one door closes, right? Another door opens.
Well, I think a big door on this is going to be, for me, I just want someone to do a good Doctor Doom. Just once. Just come on. Give us a good Doctor Doom.
Well, now there's a greater chance of that happening.
I know, and I'm thrilled. I want Doctor Doom, and I want Galactus. Those are the things I want. And I don't think it's much to ask. And something else, unfortunately, that is, I'm afraid that it is time for us to finish our drinks and head out. It's last call here at the Lobot Lounge. Maximilian has given us the red eye. Boy, that was a good rollicking discussion. Final words, gentlemen. Mark Finn?
When the Disney app becomes available, try your best not to buy into it. I think eventually they're going to get challenged on this, and it really can't happen soon enough, because I'm very leery of a corporation that cannot die, at least by without supernatural assistance, owning all of the stuff that I love. Think real hard, guys, about the choices that you make when you consume, because we're about to have to start making some really hard, fast decisions on this.
Aaron, final words?
As always, I fall on the side of the creators. Take this opportunity, folks, and look at the movies and the comics and such that you grew up with, the DC characters, the Marvel characters, the Disney characters, the Universal Monster characters, and create your own. Understand that those are now owned by huge corporations, and they will defend them rather than trying to figure out how you can get a piece of that particular pie, although that might happen. Figure out your own story that is similar to the great Universal monsters, the superheroes from the Marvel universe, from the DC universe, the Disney characters, the fairy tales that they have, you know, basically retold to great effect. Create your own, because there will always be a need for new stories. Always, there will always be a need for new stories.
And our special guest from his cave, Dr. Gonzo, any final words today?
It was fun hanging out today, and I hope that nobody thinks that anything we said was legal advice, because it wasn't.
It wasn't. Oh, by the way, Dr. Gonzo, Mickey is currently spelunking towards you with another care package of food and drink, so you'll be fine.
All right.
Nice.
Ladies and gentlemen, The Gentleman Nerds is a Cloak and Dagger production and is written by Aaron D'Arrive, Mark Finn, and Joseph Fotinos, with additional material provided by Bela Lugosi Jr. Music composed and performed by the amazingly talented Ben Gibbs. Promotional material, logos, and The Gentleman Nerds mascot, still copyrighted but nameless, created by artistic goddess Michelle Fitzpatrick. The Lobot Lounge Bouncer is Maximilian, and our special guest bartender was Captain Henry Morgan, registered trademark Captain Morgan Rum Distillery. Our sound editor, mixer, and intentional producer is Ben Gibbs. Welcome aboard. Our executive producer and the man that we all pray never gets superpowers is Aaron D'Arrive. The saga begins as copyright Weird Al Yankovic. The Pamela Anderson film Barbed Wire is a thinly disguised remake of Casablanca. Eric Binford originally pitched the idea of Alabama and the Thieves. Happy birthday, sucker. And Mark Farnash is the man in the gorilla suit. Web hosting by Rustix Interactive. Technical assistance provided by Blythe Christopher D'Arrive. Please, ladies and gentlemen, join us in the Lobot Lounge when next we open. Join us on our Facebook page, The Lobot Lounge. Share your ideas. Continue the conversation online. We want to hear from you. Always tip your bartenders and your waitstaff. I'm Joseph Fotinos, reminding you, as always, that Red Skull lives.
TM.
Nice. TM, yeah. Nice. Yeah, that would be that. Yeah. What are taglines? Are taglines copyrighted, Ben, or are they trademarked?
The tagline's part of the greater work, so it's copyrighted.
Copyright, okay.